What you are about to hear is a work of investigative journalism that explores one woman's search for answers in her son's death. The views and opinions in this podcast do not reflect those of iHeartMedia.
Previously on Somebody.
Okay, so you heard two shots fired on the block?
So when I found out what had happened, the first thing I did was reach out to the local gangbangers. None of them took admittance to it.
This whole thing is just gets stranger and stranger by the minute. And so I have theories in my head, but somebody covering for somebody.
My name is Shapiro Wells. This is a story of my son, Courtney, a young Black man in a fancy car who wound up with a bullet in his back in front of a Chicago police station. And it's the story of my search for the truth. This is Somebody.
Somebody's
everyday. So there's this thing that I haven't told you about yet. I didn't even tell Allison in the Invisible Institute for a long time. Because when it happened, I was told it wasn't important. But it turns out, it was. When I first met with police, just a few days after Courtney was shot, I told them about a tip I got on Facebook. It was from a guy who went by Randall Cunningham, like the football player. The note went like this. Good morning. I have to state I'm very sorry for your loss. I just wanted to see if this info may help you. I was coming home from the gym that night. This guy, Randall, lived in Belmont Cragen. And the night Courtney died, he saw three guys in a Grand Marquis who tossed a pistol. He called 911 twice. He sent me photos along with the message, mugshots, and a photo of the Grand Marquis that showed his license plate. Thanked him and brought it all to police.
They called the police?
That call is, that's already been addressed.
They told us that they already knew about that and that it was not related.
So this is not, you've done the research and it's not related?
Yes.
So this was a separate incident?
Separate incident, correct.
Okay.
They said it wasn't connected at all, but I still wanted to give them all the information Randall gave me anyway.
He gave me names of the two people that that he saw in that vehicle.
What names did he provide to you?
And he said it was three.
He said it was three. The third one ran.
Yeah, those.
That's all correct.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's all correct. Mm-hmm.
So it's
that information.
The caller calls in immediately, and this is well after your son was shot.
Detective Amato said Randall's 911 call was way after Courtney's shooting. To me, they were like, you know, whatever, lady. We've already decided that this is not credible. We're going to take your information, but we're not going to do anything with it. I moved on because I was grieving. I had to finish burying my son. I was planning Courtney's funeral, and at the time, I was still thinking police shot my son. And when detectives dismissed it, I thought, well, maybe they're right. But I later came to find out from those 911 call logs that Randall's first call wasn't way later than Courtney's shooting. It was 37 minutes after Courtney was shot. So when the first 911 caller's husband, Edgar, saw some gangsters in his alley in a Grand Marquis, it reminded me of Randall's tip. Allison and I, we went back and looked at the picture of the car Randall sent me on Facebook 2 years earlier. And there it was, a Grand Marquis. And the license plate started with Z44. Edgar had remembered the first two digits. And when I went back to the police report about Elena, it said that she saw a license plate starting with C44. C and Z, you know, they sound a lot alike. So the witness accounts matched up. and the police never connected the dots.
We needed to talk to this Facebook tipster, Randall Cunningham, face to face, to find out who he really was and see what else he knew about what happened that night. Any details that could help us.
My name is Allison. I got your number from Shapurl Wells, the mother of Courtney Copeland.
We texted and went to an address we found for him. No one was home, so we left a note. That night, we got a call back from Randall's uncle, who'd found the note. He put us in touch with Randall. So we made plans to meet. Randall said we could catch him after a showing of Black Panther. Bill and I waited for Randall in the food court of a suburban Chicago mall over pretzels and smoothies. Black Panther is a long movie. Finally, he came out.
Did your uncle tell you we tried to reach you at his place?
He did, and then I was like, why are the feds at the door? So I kind of thought you guys were feds. I'm like, what's going on here? But they told me it was related to the case, and I'm like, wow.
He told us that even though he'd called 911 twice, he still wanted to reach out to Shapurl directly.
I saw Mr. Copeland's mother on the news, and I felt terrible, you know? And I figured, well, why, if there's this type of information out, why wouldn't I want to try to reach out?
We asked him to walk us through what he saw when he was driving home that night, from the beginning.
I was coming home from an export gym. It was pretty late at night. As I was coming home, I noticed an individual was in the street, and I almost hit him. So I kind of looked at him, and I could tell he was gang-affiliated, colors, and his hat was cocked, and he kind of threw a sign at me, and I'm like, well, whatever.
The guy who threw the gang sign looked like he'd been running, like something had happened. Randall went to turn onto his street when he noticed a car just sitting there, a Grand Marquis.
Short time later, the car starts moving.
Randall parked and ran to his apartment. He looked out a window and saw that the Grand Marquis had driven up the block, then backed up.
And then up the block again, and then reversed and did it again. Like they were, I don't know what was going on, if they were intoxicated or whatever.
Randall called 911. The cops were on their way. Then he saw a guy get out of the car. It was the same one who had just thrown gang signs at him. And two more guys got out of the car. They tossed a weapon and scurried away. So Randall called 911 again.
You know, probably wouldn't put two and two together. And they quickly ditched the pistol. I heard like a loud thud. You can hear like a metal clank sound, like get thrown to the ground. So I actually went out to try to recover it. I didn't know what the hell came over me. I'm a concealed carry holder, so I figured, well, let me go see what this is. And there's kids on the neighborhood, so, you know, I didn't want a kid to find it.
But before Randall could get there, one of the guys came back to retrieve what they threw.
I know it was a pistol because of the way they were holding it. It was shiny. And I told the cops, hey, this was the description of the individuals, which direction they fled and which way they went and whatnot.
The cops went up the block to get the guys. The gun was gone, but Randall did find an iPhone.
So I actually went through it, and there's a couple videos of them drinking in a car. And then there was a video of them flashing a revolver. One was a revolver, the other gun was like a 9mm.
Randall offered to give the phone to police.
So they contacted me and they told me, hey, what's going on? And they were kind of brief about what they wanted, and then they hung up. And then they called back again. And I'm like, yeah, well, do you want me to come to the station or not? And they were like, well, no, at this time, no. So that was that.
And the police never followed up. And then Randall lost the iPhone in a move. We asked him about those mugshots from his Facebook message. How did he know who these guys were?
Somebody that I knew in the neighborhood knew one of the individuals in the car. So, yeah, I kind of asked, well, what had happened? And they said they were questioned, and then they were pretty much released. They never found.
He said he doesn't know the guys personally, and then the car was, but he does know of them.
I'm not gang-affiliated. Never believed in gangs or none of that, but I did believe in, you know, getting crimes figured out and solved and, you know, making sure justice is served. So,
there's one more thing you need to know about Randall. He's a Chicago police officer.
Allison, when you told me that Randall was a cop, I was shocked. But, you know, I was grateful more than anything because this information was vital.
Did it make sense once you found out he was a cop?
I thought that, well, if he wasn't a cop, he was definitely trying to be one because he knew exactly what the words to say and he knew what to give me.
So the night Courtney died, when Randall called this in to 911, he was still a civilian. He was just a guy in the neighborhood reporting what he saw. But now he's been a cop for more than 2 years. So we were a little surprised that he was still willing to talk to us.
I mean, I was just so grateful for anybody to give me information. The fact that he was a cop, it made me have some type of hope that all cops aren't bad, you know? I wish there were more Randalls on the Chicago police force.
I mean, what if he had never come forward?
Without him coming forward, we wouldn't be able to connect the dots, corroborate what Edgar and Elena said about the car and the guys inside it. But the frustrating part is, it has taken us over 2 years to get here. All of this should have been known on day one. And it turns out it was all right there on the police radio the whole time.
Two male Hispanics wearing black hoodies were sitting in the silver Grand Marquis. Appears that they threw a gun under the car.
When we asked the city for all the police dispatch in Courtney's case, we got about an hour of tape back. The first 25 minutes had Courtney flagging down Officer Block for help.
The gentleman just said he was shot.
His license plates.
Edward 551790.
His name.
The victim is male. His name is Courtney Copeland.
And Elena calling in.
One ticket of shots fired at Fullerton at Long Long and Fullerton. Caller heard two shots on the block. I got no description.
But then later in the radio tape, there's this. For 35 minutes. When we asked why this was bleeped out, the city told us, again, that it was unrelated.
We pushed back and had to wait months to get the full tape. And when you listen to it, come find out, it's completely related.
A Mercury tinted windows, reoccupants circling the block twice and then reversed. It may have a flat tire. It's double parked by the fire hydrant. There's a male black red jacket on the corner flashing gang signs.
So once again, it's up to us to investigate. We really wanted to know more about these gangsters Randall saw ditching this gun. Two of the men actually were arrested up the block the night my son was killed.
There's two male Hispanics wearing black hoodies were sitting in the silver Grand Marquis. It says he drove by and it appears that they threw a gun under the car. They have since recovered whatever was thrown under there and they're walking northbound.
The dispatcher is relaying Randall's 911 call to the police. She says two male Hispanics wearing black hoodies were sitting in a Grand Marquis. It appears they threw a gun under the car, which they've since recovered, and they're walking northbound.
That's two possibles walking westbound on Belton towards Laramie.
And then the officer says, got two possibles walking westbound on Belden toward Laramie. The police arrested two men who were charged with a parole violation for associating with gang member, which basically means they were just hanging out with each other. They were released the same day. And the third guy,
there's a man in a black red jacket on the corner flashing gang signs.
He got away.
We decided not to reveal their names because no one has been charged in connection with Courtney's case. And we don't know who, if any, of these guys shot Courtney. What we do know is that the police should have followed these leads.
But when we dug around, we found out that all three men Randall saw that night are members of the Stylers gang. All of them have been convicted of gun offenses and all have done time. They all have really long rap sheets. This is the Facebook video of one of the men who was arrested that night.
Gang, gang, bitch. Where everybody at? Take a shot for the fallen brothers, though. I'm on. We love y'all. We miss y'all. Style of crazy, Joe.
At the time of Courtney's death, he was on parole for armed robbery sentence. And the man that Randall saw flashing gang signs, he's the one that got away. He's been arrested 16 times since 2010.
Randall and Edgar identified the same type of car, but we wanted to see if they'd identify the same men inside the car, too. So we decided to do something the police had never done, a double-blind photo lineup. We put together a big stack of mugshots to show Edgar. We included the mugshots Randall sent to Chaparral and men who looked similar to them, plus some random mugshots, too. And because Edgar remembered someone in the vehicle with long hair, we included Alma's neighbor and other men with long hair.
Hi, Elena.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine.
How are you?
So my kid.
You have a little baby back here?
Yeah.
Hey there.
I went over to Elena and Edgar's again. Oh, Chaparral stayed back. We didn't want Edgar to feel any extra pressure to make an identification.
Is it okay if we sit back here?
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
We got set up in their living room.
So if you, it's, you know, very unlikely that you'll be able to identify anyone. So there's absolutely no pressure to do it. Just if you.
I brought along one of our summer reporting fellows, Matilda.
Looks like
the lineup was double blind because neither Edgar nor Matilda knew who was who in the mugshots. We didn't want to influence Edgar to pick out certain people. Elena stuck around to translate.
Okay. Ya tiene dos años que pasó eso. Tal vez no te pueda recordar, pero si puedes recordar, está bien.
All right. So I'll have you both look at them, and Matilda's gonna go through.
I left the room, and they went through the photos one by one. Edgar said, "This one looks like him a little bit."
It maybe looks like.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Photo after photo. No, he said. No, he said. No. Then he turned to the next photo. And right away, he stopped.
He thinks that one it is. Because he remembers the long hair.
He landed on the guy with the long hair, Alma's neighbor who lived by the church. That one, I think, is one of them. Edgar picked out two other mugshots. He was less sure about these. But one of them was one of the guys arrested that night up the block from Randall.
All right. Okay, that's all we had. Thank you very much.
Okay.
It just keeps going and going. You know, we're just trying to help the family find some answers.
So Randall and Edgar's accounts were matching up more and more.
Thank you, Elena.
Take care.
Thank
you.
Bye-bye. We felt like we were getting close to finding out who shot my son. So we reached out to Courtney's friend June again because we wanted to see if he can talk to some of his gang contacts. We were trying to figure out if June knew any of the guys in the mugshots.
When June asked around for us, he told us it was like opening Pandora's box. One day, two gang chiefs showed up at his door. They said, "You've been asking a lot of questions." After that, June changed his number and moved. When we caught up with him again months later, he said he didn't want to have an ear to the streets anymore. He wanted to have an ear to the stock market because he was all about his cigar business. He was done dealing information.
With June out of the picture, we chased a different lead, the car. We wanted to track down that Grand Marquis, but it wasn't registered to anyone anymore. We did find out who owned the Grand Marquis when Courtney was killed. Her first name was Crystal. We didn't know anything about her except for her address, so we hit the road.
So it's not that far.
No, she's pretty close, but within a mile, you know.
Mm-hmm. On the way, we talked about Courtney, like we always do.
He always said he was going to be famous. I don't think this is what he wanted to be famous for. But he had this ominous feeling that he was going to die young. You know, I think he had some fear and some anxiety because His father and his grandfather also died of heart issues. We're going where, Allison?
Yeah, so just take it a little further south.
Anyway, the last anxiety attack he had was probably about 6 weeks before he died. And he was like, I think I'm having a heart attack. And I'm like, Courtney, you're not having a heart attack. If you were having a heart attack, you wouldn't be able to sit here and tell me to take you to the doctor. So he was like, I just keep seeing myself dying. Because I knew what it was. I knew he was having a panic attack. I told him, you do what I told you to do, which is pray. We're all here on borrowed time, Courtney. You know, not thinking in 6 weeks, my son will be dead. That was the last serious, serious conversation that I had with Courtney before he died. Crystal Street was lined with matching brick two flats. We didn't want to freak her out, so we left the recorder behind. We walked up to her building and rang the doorbell for her apartment. We waited. We were about to walk away when a woman came out.
It was Crystal. We showed her a picture of the Grand Marquis. She said, yes, that used to be her car. We told her about Courtney's murder and that witnesses pointed to this car. She said she got rid of that car before 2016 on Craigslist.
We showed her the mugshots of the guys. She said she didn't know any of them.
We were bummed. We had hoped she could tell us more. We thanked her and got back into the van.
Well, I definitely think she's lying. I think she does know more than what she's saying. And she wants to make sure that it's not traceable back to her. I think when you showed her the pictures, that really threw her. What do you think, Allison?
I don't know. She seemed genuinely caught off guard and surprised,
yeah.
You know, but I don't know.
Shapiro was right. Crystal was lying to us. A few weeks later, we were digging around in some court documents, and we saw Crystal was listed as the girlfriend of the guy who got away from the cops that night. They even have kids together. We found some photos of him on Facebook. One of the pictures shows him at a gravesite with one of the two stylers arrested the night Courtney died. Now we had evidence connecting them to each other and the car. We hadn't heard from Randall in a while. Until one morning, November 1st, 2018, he texted me. Did you hear what happened on Long and Belden? Female executed in front of her kids and friend over a car. Be safe in that neighborhood. My stomach dropped. It was the same corner where Courtney was shot. And the car was a BMW. It was all over the news.
This is just absolutely heartbreaking. The victim's family says she was out celebrating Halloween and was trick-or-treating with her twin sister and two nieces when a masked man jumped into their car and forced them to drive.
Police want to find out why a young woman was murdered by a masked man who forced his way into the car.
CBS 2's V Wynn live at the 25th District Police Station in Belmont, Cragen, with more.
The gunman made them drive several blocks before he shot and killed one of the women. On the same street where the gangsters and the Grand Marquis tossed the gun. The gunman took off running to Black Hawk Park, Styler's territory.
Okay, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
I got on the phone with Shapiro right away.
Have you seen the news today? Yeah, you know that shooting right by Courtney, right?
Yeah, exactly right by Courtney. It was Belden and Long right past the church.
I'm looking at the address. I'm like, oh, my God. Yeah. This is, like, right here.
I told her it was a BMW, too.
Are you serious? This is, like, just sent my PTSD right off the rails.
I know. I'm sorry.
We discussed whether we should go to the police with what we knew.
But
they have that information, though, Allison.
I know they have it, but they don't understand its significance. But I just...
it doesn't feel like they did the kind of detective work that we've done.
Because I'm thinking, like, if you know, I know my son was gone, but did this other girl have to die? You know what I'm saying? It has always been about preventing things from happening to other people for me. If this is the same person, I'm hoping that they would actually follow up.
In the end, we decided we had a responsibility to come forward. If there was any chance our findings could help them solve this woman's murder.
I really didn't want to meet with those jokers again, but I sucked it up. Maybe this time, if I came in with two white journalists, they'd actually listen to me.
Allison, it's Detective Amato. I spoke with you a little earlier.
So we called to set something up.
Sergeant Mitchell and one of the supervisors from here will be contacting you sometime.
A few days later, me, Allison, and Bill were sitting down with Sergeant Mitchell and Detective Amato. They agreed to meet us only if I didn't record, but the meeting was on the record.
What did you think about the police stipulating that you couldn't record?
And I wish we would have recorded. I do. I promise you I wanted to. I really did. We met for about 2 hours in the same conference room as before, but no one walked out on me this time. Sergeant Mitchell, he wore a tie and was red-faced as ever. Detective Amato wore a pullover. He barely took any notes.
Here's what happened. We brought in two huge binders of documents, and we told police what we knew.
So we walked them through our evidence. Allison started by showing them a map. We highlighted the corner of Belden and Long by the church where the neighbors heard the shots that night. We told them we believed this is where Courtney was shot because his friends found broken glass on the street. And others, they saw skid marks. And it's where Courtney usually parked because he'd received tickets there before. At this point, they said we weren't telling them anything they didn't already know.
But we kept laying out the scene for them anyway. We explained that right before the incident, we believe Courtney was parking his car. He was on his phone, texting Alma, Facebook messaging his friend. He was distracted. That's when someone shot him. Courtney turned and ducked, getting hit in the back. When Courtney sped off towards the police station, a Grand Marquis quickly drove around the block, cutting through Elena and Edgar's narrow alleyway, with the windows rolled down, giving Edgar a good look. 2 years later, Edgar still remembered the car and the first few digits of the license plate. At this point, we showed police the two mugshots Edgar picked out in the double-blind lineup. The man with the long hair, Alma's neighbor, and a second guy, a member of the Stylers gang, who was arrested that night. And that's when the detectives said to each other that they needed to talk to Edgar.
Then we kept going with the play-by-play. Right after my son arrived at the hospital, Randall spotted the Grand Marquis on his block and called 911. When the guys heard the police coming, they tossed the gun under the car nearby and took off on foot. But before police could retrieve the gun, someone came back for it. Two of the guys were arrested up the block and released without questioning. The third one got away. We gave police his name.
We gave them a copy of Randall's Facebook message about the Grand Marquis, license plate, the weapon, the mugshots.
That's when one of the detectives said, "You never told me this." But I did. Remember? I even have it on tape.
I also have some information that I received from another Facebook person randomly. They told me that the night of the shooting, there was a what kind of
car?
It looks like a Grand Marquis. I have that plate number.
Like your plate number.
They said that they were looking out their window, mm-hmm. and they saw them throw a gun up under the truck.
Under the truck. Mm-hmm.
They called the police.
That call is already been addressed.
None of us were surprised about how detectives acted during this meeting. Detective Amato said he'd seen the video of Courtney outside the station. That much I already knew. But what surprised me was he said he didn't think Courtney was being combative. I didn't know what to make of this. No one had their story straight. Was this a cover-up? Or are they just this damn incompetent? At the end of our meeting, they told us they were going to assign new detectives to the case and work these new leads. We all hopped in Bill's car in the parking lot to regroup.
You called me, dear. I had to bite my tongue so many times. It was so patronizing.
I think he called someone darling, too.
I felt that they were a little bit evasive when they talked about the two being arrested that night and why they couldn't. It was a murder. Why wouldn't you want to investigate them? They're known gang members. They have a long rap sheet. So tell me why you couldn't pull them in for questioning for this murder. Why wouldn't you do that? That didn't make sense to me because they're already arrested. And then you also had that 911 caller who was giving you a description of suspects that he's seen in the neighborhood who threw a gun underneath a car. So this is when they talk about we don't have enough evidence. We don't have enough probable cause to pull them over. Hell, you get pulled over for a busted light in Chicago and they question you. They take you out your car. They handcuff you. They do all types of stuff. So you telling me that you don't have enough evidence or enough probable cause, that's bullshit.
And I wanted to reiterate to them that, you know, insofar as they were frequently saying that these are leads, not evidence, this is circumstantial. And it's sort of like, yeah, I know. I am coming to you because another woman was killed in a BMW on that corner. Like, I'm not saying that this is solid evidence ready to go to court. I am saying that this is what I know about the case, and it's more than what you know about the case.
Bill noticed something during the meeting. I had turned my face away because I was crying, and I didn't want the detective to see.
Were you crying out of frustration?
I was crying because my son is still dead. At the end of the day, my son dead. So it's just like, and I must admit, I'm finna get emotional now, so forgive me, you know, because I'm like, you know, every time I get closer, I get a setback. And I sometimes I'd be like, okay, you have to stop. You have to stop for yourself, for your health. You have to stop for your kids, for your husband. Because this whole murder it's like a ticking time bomb that just like exploded in my life. And you're trying to take the millions of pieces and put them together. And so parts of me will never, ever be whole. It's an emotional strain on my family, my husband, my marriage. It's all of this. So the last couple of days, I've just been going through it.
We needed to step away. I hoped that the police would finally do their jobs.
I think that right now, based on us leaving them with the information that we left them with, that they're just going to appease us by passing us off to some new detectives. Nothing is going to happen. They're not going to interview. They're not going to follow up. They're not going to even investigate anything other than what they've already done. My son will still be a cold case in Chicago.
So it's been more than a year since we sat down with detectives. Chaparral, what's happened in the last year?
Absolutely nothing. You hear crickets. They haven't called me. They haven't given me any updates. They haven't contacted any of the witnesses that we gave them. I haven't heard a peep from police. We've checked in with Edgar, Randall, Elena, all of these witnesses, and they haven't contacted them.
Press 3. Or to speak to an operator, press 0. Please speak after the tone. Hi, Detective Bausch. My name is Shapiro Wells. I'm the parent of Courtney Copeland. I was calling to get a status update on his case. He was murdered on March 4th, 2016.
A couple of weeks later, after I left this message, Allison actually ran into one of the detectives on Courtney's case, Detective Amato. She bumped into him at Sesame Street Live. She was there with her family, and Amato was working security. She said hello and reminded him about the case. 2 weeks later, Amato called me. I was at church.
Hi, Miss Wells. This is Detective Amato over at Area North. I was wondering if you could give me a call back at your earliest convenience.
I called him back as soon as I got home. Then I hopped back on the line with Allison.
Okay. Hey, Shapiro. Hey. Okay. So basically, his call was based on him wanting to all of a sudden put Courtney's case in the cold case file and make it a profile on their website.
What does that mean?
So he wants to put Courtney's photo and everything onto the website, stating that they're looking for information.
Yeah. Did he say he had not talked to Edgar yet?
He ain't talked to Edgar.
Right.
He basically admitted that he ain't talked to Edgar.
And what about?
Or Randall.
So they basically didn't follow up on our leads over the last year, and now they're wanting to all of a sudden put it in the cold case unit.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, how are you feeling?
I felt like he was blowing smoke because it was like, oh, I'm thinking about your son's case, and I've been trying, whatever, dude. I'm like,
well,
and he was like, well, if you want to meet with me again and we'll go over everything, I'm like, yeah.
I mean, we already gave them everything.
And I was trying to tell him, I said, that's why we were wondering, why didn't you speak to Elena's husband? Because I said, I basically told him, I said, that information matched. Elena's husband said a Grand Marquis. Randall said a Grand Marquis. And I said, it wasn't that far in between from the initial shooting.
Wow.
You had this stuff for a year and you ain't did nothing.
When I watch the news, I keep seeing over and over again whose lives matter and whose cases matter enough to solve. No matter how many times I meet with the police, my son's murder still doesn't seem to matter to them. But this whole thing is so much bigger than who pulled the trigger on my son. It's so much bigger than Courtney's case. Things don't have to be this way. And there's so much more I've got to do.
Everybody's somebody's every day. Nobody's nothing. Oh, nobody. That's right.
Somebody is a co-production of The Invisible Institute, The Intercept, Topic Studios, and iHeartRadio in association with Tenderfoot TV. I'm Shapiro Wells. This podcast is produced by Allison Flowers and Bill Healy. Sarah Geis is our story editor. Ellen Glover is our associate producer. For The Invisible Institute, Jamie Calvin is executive producer. For Topic Studios, Maria Zuckerman, Christy Gressman, and Lital Malad are executive producers. Special thanks to Lizzie Jacobs. For The Intercept, Roger Hodge, deputy editor, is supervising producer. Sound design by Carl Scott and Bart Warshaw. Our theme song, Everybody's Something, is by Chance the Rapper. Original music for the podcast by Nate Fox of The Social Experiment and Eric Butler. Additional reporting by Sam Stecklow, Annie Nguyen, Kahari Blackburn, Rajiv Sinclair, Henry Adams, Matilda Voyak, Dana Brozos Kelleher, Francis McDonald, Diana Akmajian, Maddie Anderson, Andrew Fan, and Urissa Apentaku. Translation support by Benny Hernandez Ocampo and Emma Perez. Fact-checking by Nawal Arjeni. Special thanks to Chris Rasmussen, Bennett Epstein, Matt Topic, David Braylo, and Julie Wolf. We want to hear from you. Email us at info@somebodypodcast.com or leave us a voicemail at 773-270-0121. To learn more about this case and for links to additional materials, go to our show page at somebodypodcast.com. You can also find a list of everyone we want to thank there. So many people helped us along the way.